everyone who is watching, we'll be talking to none other than Sam Rule from the Bitcoin Magazine Pro Team. And I first wanted, before we dive in, just make sure everyone knows the Bitcoin Magazine Pro exists. It is a free newsletter that Dylan, LeClaire, and Sam Rule put together on a weekly basis, correct? There's more content than just a week.
Yeah, right? No, I can give some context on it. We do daily and weekly basis. It's a free and paid newsletter. Research analysis on Bitcoin markets, anything related to on-chain, derivatives, equities, macro, kind of a mix of anything that can move or explain the Bitcoin market that Dylan and I are researching. So we have free tier if you're interested. We're trying to push out a lot more free content over the next few months. Usually we do one or two issues a week. And then for paid tier, try to do about four or five issues a week and some other benefits. So I got a link in my Twitter bio if anyone's interested in checking it out. They haven't already.
We're going to pin some stuff up to the top, but also be sure, guys, we're going to be going over some charts in a moment. So be sure to join us over on the YouTube stream as well, so you can actually see these charts in action. We've pinned a link so you can actually, okay. Chris, I'm going to let you handle pinning what needs to be pinned so that I can actually have this conversation. Sam, I'd love to start things off with the Fed. That's where the conversation just ended with P, myself, and Chris. We hear Janet Yellen coming out and saying, hey, I was wrong. We heard Biden sit down with Powell and Yellen for probably like 3 days. And of the 3 days that they sat, there was about 3 minutes that they could share of worthy content. Curious where your head is at from the latest rumblings out of the Fed. We're 2 weeks out from the next FOMC meeting with expectations at a 50 basis point hike. Last thing I saw was that it's almost at 0%, the likelihood for a 75 basis point hike. So just initially, what are your thoughts with what's going on as far as the Fed goes and everything else?
Sure. Yeah. And it'd be good to hear maybe a little collective summary of what you guys were talking about before. But the way I see it is kind of over the last few months, like just from a macro perspective framework, is that the Fed is now, as we saw with like Janet Yellen and has been for some time, kind of owning up to the inflation is transitory type narrative and saying, hey, we made a huge mistake, got it wrong, kind of oversubscribed a lot of liquidity in the system from both a kind of fiscal and monetary policy perspective back in COVID, didn't slam kind of the brakes earlier that they probably needed to. And now you get in a kind of a tough place where the only thing they can afford to do politically is kind of like curb inflation as much as possible. So I think that's where all of a sudden, the Fed shifts from, okay, hey, we're on both sides of markets here. We can kind of go back and forth to over like the short 3 to 6 month medium term of saying, well, we're so wrong about inflation and that, you know, maybe there's some embarrassment there from like a decision-making perspective. And politically, it's, you know, one of the worst things to have for population to be going under inflation over, you know, just the minimum of what CPI 8% is, that really like they're left with no choice but to print these 50 basis point hikes. So, and I think at this point too, and like in a total unstable, volatile macro environment, the last thing you want to do is be going switching back and forth from this policy. So how I see it, and you know, I know a lot in the past, it's been like, okay, Fed jawboning, they're saying they're gonna raise rates, they're managing markets, they're doing like that. I think in this case, gonna see a series of 50 basis point hikes to the next few meetings. I think that's pretty expected in markets now and pricing. And then you get to essentially maybe like a Fed funds rate, you know, over something of 2% or around there, and then start to talk about, okay, is there, kind of see what happens in terms of that rate hike and also the kind of tightening that's happening now. So now we're not doing tapering, but kind of treasury runoffs from the balance sheet is starting to go forth a little bit too. So after you're essentially going to see like a few months of that time, and then the Fed try to reassess like how much damage is essentially coming from that. But I think my framework is that in terms of like the inflation has to be the number one priority over essentially what they say their mandate is and the job market as well and unemployment. And they're going to do whatever is necessary to rate hikes and try to just curb demand as much as possible. Obviously, they said now that there's nothing they can do about supply chain issues, and they don't have that power and certainly don't. But, you know, they can try to curb demand and push it as down as possible, which then you run in the risk of essentially getting into recession territory. Signs aren't necessarily showing that already. So maybe that is like the general path, or like the general framework that I think of, is that like these rate hikes are coming. I'm not sure how they can curb inflation back to essentially their median 2% target without kind of forcing an inflation or a recession. And so now I think there's just going to be like some stability over the next few months in terms of the 50 basis point hikes that they want to put out.
You know, we hear a lot about the various causes for inflation. I'm starting to, like, I mean, I never believed anything the government said. I definitely equated a lot of it to the money printing itself. But I wonder how much of it, in your opinion, is rooted around like the stimulus and the money that we are inherently spending, and how much is like, how much higher can prices really go before the government steps in and does something absolutely crazy, like set price locks on certain goods or services? And I know I'm having a very speculative conversation with you.
Yeah, no, sure. Totally. I guess how I see, like, from the inflation narrative, at least in the inflation that we look at today, in terms of like the price inflation and how it's measured in the CPI and things we're buying. And that's different from obviously asset price inflation that QE's likely had an effect on over the last decade. But it's really, I think, the combination of both the monetary and fiscal kind of injection that we had during 2020 in COVID that is really doing all of this, right? Injecting those trillions of dollars into a place, giving it to consumer demand while supply chain was unfolding anyway, issues in supply chain there. So I think it's largely that it's hard to, when you think of like, okay, QE making its way into kind of the bank reserves, but not necessarily that making it into the real economy. I think there's certainly tons of research and study to point to, okay, well, that has made its way possibly into asset markets and equity valuations over the last decade. But I think really in the prices that, you know, you and I are buying today in terms of food, rent, all those things, is like largely that kind of fiscal monetary policy stimulus combination, kind of debt monetization that we had in 2020. And there's a lot of good like Fed research academic papers of saying like that essentially like this was the next step because of the lack of inflation that in terms of like the CPI that QE has spawned over the last decade of trying to spur that. So really in terms of crisis territory, it was how do we do both these in combination? And that's kind of a new tool that we haven't really seen in a kind of an experiment at large. So that's kind of how I see largely what's driving that. And then obviously on the supply side, it's just making things worse. I think you could easily make the case too that, you know, from like a monetary unit perspective, like fiat currency that we have, that's been very misconstrued. So price signals over time get worse and compounded. It's harder to measure. And then I guess in terms of like where prices are and how much higher they can go, I don't necessarily have like this high target of saying, and be curious if you have any thoughts on like, hey, this is where I think inflation or where prices are going to go next. If anything, what I start to see in the data is that like inflation looks like it's elevated and here to stay, but it is reaching a little bit of a turning point, at least in the data that's measured by the United States, and that it's going through like a potential peak right now. And so not to say that like everything is going to come down to like 2% inflation or 3% inflation, everything's likely going to remain elevated until we start to see how well QT does at curbing some of this demand and have like this demand destruction. But I'm not so certain that like on a CPI, like an acceleration basis, that, you know, we're going to see like 10, 15% type inflation in the United States.
I think I'm just too bearish. Like one thing that I keep paying attention to and that genuinely worries me is the fact that the price for a barrel of oil still hasn't hit the all-time high from 2007-2008, nor has it even come up on, I have a chart pulled up, on the highs it reached back in 1980. So like there's still a lot more runway to go. And one thing that it's interesting how it's been, it flip-flopped. you saw 2 weeks ago, companies like Target and Walmart release earnings reports that shattered the entire consumer discretionary market. You saw every single company in that space sell off. And then this past week, I believe it was, Dollar Tree starts actually saying that we actually had good numbers. And the only justification in my head that I have as to why a company like Target and Walmart struggled, but a company like Dollar Tree was successful is you're catering to, yes, a lower demographic to begin with. So you can't go anywhere else to start. You're probably bringing in customers from Walmart and Target into your shop. But Walmart and Target have been trying to compete with Amazon. They've been trying to do a lot of shipping. They've been trying to expand. And as the price of oil and gas goes up, both Target and Walmart actually cited that they haven't felt or necessarily passed on, I'm paraphrasing here, the rising cost of oil for their operations has not been felt by their consumers yet. So you have that impending rise in just general cost of goods that's looming for the average American, on top of the fact that we are depleting our oil supplies and reserves. It all comes in, starts and ends with oil, in my opinion. And that's where I think what is most likely is someone from the government starting to throw out the idea of let's cap the price of gas. And that will be a very, very dangerous and very scary thing, because you will piss off the biggest cartel in the world that is already pissed that 2 years ago the world laughed and mocked that we let the price of oil get negative, and they never want that to happen again. And if they buy into the narrative that like we're going to be a fully green ecosystem, which like we're so far away from that, it's laughable. But there's a little bit of fear that like if that becomes a possibility, like all these oil rich countries are going to be depleted of the amount of wealth and the status that they have, so they might as well cash in on this last go around. That's just my two cents on it, but we're not here to listen to me, we're here to listen to you.
No, that's totally fair. And I think obviously energy prices makes it a totally different conversation, how long that's going to take and what it's doing now to prices of goods and production costs around the world. And I guess on the end of it too, it's really like how hot can inflation run? How high can prices get before essentially from like a consumer sentiment perspective that growth and purchases and things that can be had can still continue and kind of essentially maintain that inflation as well. So you mentioned Target, Walmart, I mean, basically any large company that you're taking now across tech as well, all big earning misses across the board, essentially seeing like more and more kind of growth slowdown estimates coming out. And so, you know, on the flip side of that, after like you have these inflationary periods and what we're going through now, essentially, you know, the solution to rising prices is that essentially kills demand. And so then you get these, you know, deflationary events that can play out after. So I think that's the other side of things when you start thinking about like recession territory and also just like a lower growth and a weakening consumer from like an inflation adjusted sales standpoint, from an increase in like a massive increase in terms of the revolving credit that consumers are facing today, low personal savings rates, essentially like how high can those inflation prices be sustained by the everyday individual? So it's a good point. It's hard to tell sometimes in the market, like regimes like to think of it in kind of this grid quadrant style framework. This is the old like Ray Dalio framework. And there's a lot of good macro research shops that use this. But essentially, you know, are we in more of a stagflationary environment where inflation is constantly accelerating, ticking up month over month and low growth? And are we then, does that then lead to more of a deflation environment where inflation is still accelerated, potentially peaked, but like growth is turning down with it? So you don't really have growth to help, you know, maintain some of those higher prices for long as well.
Pop over to slide number three, because you were incredible, awesome, and essentially put together a chart where, again, reminder for everyone, we are over on YouTube and you can see the chart that we are looking about and about to discuss, but you've essentially shown the Bitcoin price action from November of 2021, in addition to some select major tech stocks from Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, Google, and Tesla and Netflix. The first thing a smooth brain person like me looks at and sees is, wow, Bitcoin was the second worst asset in this group. I'm curious, like, we, Netflix aside, because I think Netflix becomes a weird little outlier in this conversation. I see something like this and I'm like, oh, the volatility on Bitcoin is greater than the volatility on all other tech stocks. Volatility is not always a negative drawdown, and you didn't really see Bitcoin, like, it doesn't really look to me like Bitcoin did anything drastic. A lot of these stocks had moments where an earnings report came out and they had to sell off sharply and hard. Bitcoin was a very steady decline, it looks like. Sam, share with us sort of what your takeaways are staring at this chart and what you're seeing or noticing.
Yeah, for sure. So I think in one particular, I think it's interesting from perspective of, like, as all of these things turn down, the entire equity market, I mean, not just FANG here, but I think it's easy to say with how Bitcoin trades in terms of its correlations, and we've covered it like many times, whether it's the NASDAQ or IVG is another related tech indice stock, or just the FANG itself here, that Bitcoin has traded a lot like these and continues to do so. I think that is just the nature of where it's at today, its final financialization process. And so in one way, you're saying, okay, Bitcoin is just tech, or it's just trading that way. I think in the other side of it is saying, okay, everything is like, is in this almost one-to-one correlated market now as well. And so even these larger names that we're seeing, it's very rare that you're going to see 30, 40, 50% drawdowns in these bigger tech stocks, talking about ones that are some of the most successful companies in the world. But you have Bitcoin kind of competing in par with that. And so for people that have been around like a Bitcoin cycle, seen 80% drawdowns, the volatility, the cyclical nature of it, like multiple times, I think if you're new to Bitcoin or new investors and getting into it, of course, like 53% like down drawdown is going to shake you. But I mean, essentially now that's happening everywhere in the market. So I would actually say, like, if you've been in Bitcoin for a while, or if you're holding a decent position in there, and you've gone through a drawdown like this before, or at least you understand that it can do this, that's pretty kind of normal and understood. And I think people get used to that kind of conviction and risk, but not so much here in terms of equity. So I would say in terms of performance for the rest of the market, I'm not necessarily saying like that this is a bottom or like this is where we are from drawdown. I actually probably more on the bear side of things, that things are actually going to get worse for in just terms of like equity return performance and Bitcoin overall. But I think it is promising to look at this and say it's holding up pretty strong relative to what the rest of kind of major equity market is, where most of the money allocated in equities is. And so I think that's a pretty impressive thing to just say Bitcoin's 13 years old. It's always seen as this speculation, this liquidity. But when you compare it from all time high drawdowns in terms of returns, that it's not too far off from the major stocks we're seeing.
I'm curious, in all of these sort of tech stocks that we're talking about or looking at, these are the mega caps more or less. I'm curious if any of these to you look interesting, or if Bitcoin itself just continues to be sort of that through line for you. And yes, I know the answer to this question already.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So when I think about, like, I guess you're thinking of talking about allocating to some of these first Bitcoin, essentially like prospects. Yeah. So for me, I probably don't look into like individual equities as much, as mostly focused on Bitcoin. And I think the rationale and the reasoning for that is, I mean, you're looking at a $1 trillion asset. In my head, you know, the total addressable market, TAM is a cliche word at this point, but like is orders of magnitude higher than that, 100x higher than that over time, in my head, for what a decentralized money kind of store value, medium of exchange, multiple use cases for what Bitcoin can be. So how I think of like the macro cycle is essentially is like, what is the upside or the drawdown period that you would want to put money into something versus a 5-10 year time horizon? I'm sure people could model out Amazon's growth or Google's, Microsoft's returns better than me, and what that can mean for your upside over the next decade. I also think it's different too. I mean, some of these things are some of the like best performing businesses in the world, and they have a much lower potential, maybe growth profile at the stage that they are now than something like Bitcoin does. So I think Bitcoin is really, you're saying it's a $1 trillion asset. You're saying it's a market, could be well over 100 trillion kind of in the long run of things. You're taking that bet. So just from an asymmetric upside bet of like where it is today, I think it's a different discussion. Also, I think it's a different discussion of whether like wealth preservation or like you're trying to grow into, you know, take a bet on what you think is going to be like a completely different future of the world. So I guess I think of them in different ways. And I think that would go to the point too, that the market doesn't necessarily think of them in different ways right now. Obviously it trades like tech, it follows that. I mean, that's where most institutions financialization is happening. And so maybe then, you know, that could lead into, if we want to talk about some like potential decoupling periods in Bitcoin's future. I mean, for me, it's just that Bitcoin takes a lot of education and research to understand its place in the world. And then you got to be convinced by that thesis and argument as well too. It's kind of been a hotbed for speculation and liquidity. It's speculative by nature. So I think it's an education piece too, that I think we're just starting to see play out. Like, you know, it might take, you know, a couple, two or three more years until you see a lot more sophistication and grasping of what Bitcoin can become.
Chris, can you pop us over to slide number 2? Because I think this is a really interesting one to point out. Like, I've been pounding the drum so obnoxiously about the correlation. However, this chart, while it does send a signal that like, oh, when the NASDAQ was going up, so was Bitcoin on this log scale. But the correlation really tightened over the course of, I would say, like from November to roughly now, where you see it trading almost in lockstep in certain occasions. Like, we don't need to speculate on what's causing this. There are 100 different theses. The right answer is because people, big funds, are treating this as a risk on asset. There's no other right answer to that. But I'm curious, Sam, if there is, like, looking at this chart, what are your takeaways? What are you paying attention to? And what would be the first sign on some, looking at a chart like this, that Bitcoin has started its decoupling process from the NASDAQ?
Definitely. So I think biggest takeaway, like when you look at a chart like this or any chart of the market right now since November, and there's been like a big shift of focus in our research and trying to talk about, is like it's everything is as close to being one trade right now as possible. And that affects Bitcoin, that affects equities, that affects the NASDAQ. And we're kind of still in that type of regime. And that's going to be based on kind of the market regimes that we're in today, where growth is headed, where inflation is headed, where the credit market is headed, just the level of volatility right now, kind of in this rush to cash and this repositioning, and people, as we progress through what looks to be kind of like an extended bear market that we're in, it's just kind of how things are going to go. And we study a lot in terms of, when Dylan and I, we go through a lot of the on-chain metrics and look at the economic behavior on there. But really, at the end of the day, when you have a $1 trillion asset class and pools of hundreds and hundreds of trillions in a major market move that we're going through today, I mean, really all you have to do is pull up one of these charts. You can pull up the VIX volatility index for the S&P. Same with the dollar index as well, or related to a basket of currencies. And as those things go up, Bitcoin goes down. And that's just kind of how it has been, same with equities as well. And so I see it as like that essentially we're going to need some higher volatility move event, some higher breaking of something, some major kind of move, whether that's a dovish pivot and like a liquidity injection at a huge, large scale that like we've never seen before. Maybe that's something in the credit markets becoming a lot more insolvent, potentially impacts on like emerging markets credits or like credit spreads blowing out. So the spread between a lot of the corporate junk bonds that we see today, between the treasury bills that we have. And so that's kind of the thesis that we've been working through for a while, is that it seems now in this like volatility uncertainty event that everything is just like a little bit on pause as people reposition, try to think about inflation deflation dynamics. And so I guess what I'm looking for from like a Bitcoin standpoint is that when we do have this bottoming out, is how I see it, at least. And, you know, that's what make markets and market opinions, is that some people might have think we've already made that bottom. I think the worst is yet to come, is that Bitcoin surprises people that it doesn't really go tank below, just throw a price out of your 20,000 or something and sustain below there, then it has a quick bounce. And that the people see the demand flowing back into it. And it's not just about like a reflating of liquidity demand, but it's just the demand that's been happening for Bitcoin for a while. So I think the biggest critique, like macro critique that I see quite a bit is, and I think it can be fair based on some analysis, if people haven't studied Bitcoin as much, or they study it and they don't think it's the right thing for the future, is essentially they say it's just all like a liquidity lottery trade at this point. And so I think that would prove a lot of people wrong, to have like a pretty strong short Bitcoin bottom that shows a lot of demand and interest and adoption in it, and that it's not just going to like slowly grind down and disappear over the next year.
I'm curious, and this again, just we're talking to friends and a lot of people are eavesdropping. Like the last time Bitcoin had its bull run breaking out above its previous all-time high, that's not true, because it made an all-time high, contracted, then it made a new all-time high just shortly above it. But I want to talk about like the 2020 bull run, where we saw early on, you had that cataclysmic event where COVID happens, lockdowns happens, everything, stock market, Bitcoin, crypto markets, everything crashed for a moment. And then you started to have a quick, speedy recovery. You have interest rates get crashed down to zero, and you have stimulus just get injected into people's wallets, into different businesses, into the stock market. I'm curious which of these two sides of the coin, increasing government spending or decreasing of interest rates, you think is going to be most helpful for Bitcoin, like from a price perspective, growth?
I think it would probably be an increase in more fiscal stimulus is how I would try to think of it. That's really what that at least would make the proposition for Bitcoin a lot more apparent in terms of like the monetary inflation supply. I think the difficult when you say like, okay, interest rates are dropping, people are going to essentially safe haven in treasuries. That's more of a, maybe a market shift. But it also keeps capital cheap for people to reinvest in those assets as well. But I think the fiscal stimulus showed a direct link to, hey, here is this monetary printing that is affecting prices for all of us, and make the use case more apparent for what Bitcoin is really about in terms of this tool or this money that doesn't have this debasement, essentially, that can happen in the play out. So maybe because it's more apparent now from a market impact perspective, obviously we've seen what low interest rates and QE have done for assets and equities over the last 10 years. Potentially we go through another wave of that, but maybe from like a user consumer adoption perspective, there's probably no better marketing right now to start sowing the seeds for people than to see kind of a monetary system get out of control in terms of the inflation that we're seeing today. So that's kind of my hunch. I mean, there's not a lot of data, it's more speculation to back that, but I would think that it would make the use case more apparent, because I think a lot of the use case right now in terms of the United States or the Western world for Bitcoin is really just about, and what we've been talking about too, is just about the price, it's about the investment. It's about the growth potential in the next decade. It's not necessarily about wanting to use the monetary network or the money that it is. And I think that goes in waves, but generally my thoughts on that.
I mean, I'd love your thoughts. Like what right now that's getting developed on the network level are you most excited for? Are you paying closest attention to?
Yeah, for sure. I think in times like this, what you want to see is like the increase in adoption and adoption for like what is going to be the next stage of Bitcoin. So I just think Lightning as a whole, I think it just hit in terms of like what we know in public capacity, because there's a lot of private capacity on Lightning, is reaching now to 4,000 Bitcoin in terms of capacity. So I think, you know, in a large part, a lot of people focus on price, but you try to look for like these adoption pieces to say, okay, what is going to be like the fundamental drivers and the use cases much beyond where it's going. So in general, I'm most excited about Lightning. It's something that like I get to use in like my daily kind of weekly routine, although that is a little bit more fun. But I mean, that is like the use case that I think in a lot of places that's going to bring a lot more people to the network, because it goes beyond just like the investment kind of Bitcoin sitting as like a HODL technology in there. So that's mostly, you know, probably what I'm most excited for.
And just for smooth brain people like me, like adoption on Lightning to you, does that mean more nodes opening Lightning channels? Does that mean transactions has increased tenfold from what we see today? Like, talk to us, let's break that down.
Yeah, totally. I think there's a lot of ways you could look at it. Nodes is certainly one way. I generally like to think of it as like public capacity, because capacity being like how much essentially demand is needed and flowing through on Lightning. I think nodes is certainly one way. Obviously, you can just increase capacity through nodes, and whether that's, you know, necessarily, you know, one user doing it or a node using it on the behalf of, or I should say, whether that's like, you know, a million people getting on the Lightning or one people using higher capacity on Lightning. I think that's really the most interesting thing, that it can grow. And this is from Bitcoin's perspective too. You could have a huge amount of capital move in and with a smaller amount of people, and that still shows pretty strong adoption. So I look at it both. I look at it in nodes. I look at the public capacity. Try to look at the amount of like, I know Arcane's done a good report on this, of trying to say how many companies are essentially rolling out and like enabling Lightning and wallets on there as well. I mean, I think that always with the tricky thing in Lightning is it's got a private element to it that you're not going to be able to see the adoption, the data happening. So really looking at like the exponential growth, like year on year, over year in terms of like the capacity is interesting. And just the number of like capable services or wallets, like when you think of like Cash App or Kraken and integrating it now with accounts. So like potentially the number of accounts that you have out there in the wild that have some connection to Bitcoin that Lightning is a part of. And watching that grow, I think is maybe the best way to see a kind of adoption coming in.
I love that. Sam, before I corner you into talking to us about price action and these beautiful Bitcoin charts that you took the time to put together, is there anything else you want to talk more on a macro level before we dive into the on-chain stuff?
No, I think that's good. I think we go through, definitely like revisit some of the macro thesis stuff a decent amount. I would just say from like a price action standpoint, you know, something I'm looking for, a number that I've seen a lot in macro quantitative research, and one that is mostly like a median back test of like where we're going in terms of equities and kind of S&P 500 index in terms of drawdown, is somewhere around like that 30% level, where I think we've reached about 17%. So in my case, from what I look at, we'll get in some of these Bitcoin charts too, which is kind of showing that bearish case. Just from that macro perspective, I think Dylan and I kind of shifted to focusing on how far can this fall over in terms of January. And so still that kind of thesis where we're looking for kind of like a volatility or credit spread blow up. And especially when we're starting to see a lot more in terms of the earnings and the growth fall over, that's kind of like what we have in mind in Bitcoin to follow that. So I'll just leave it at that. But I know we've talked about that quite a bit.
And guys, I cannot emphasize or stress this enough. The content that Sam and Dylan put together for the Bitcoin Magazine Pro newsletter is exceptional. If you are enjoying this conversation, if you want deeper analysis on that stuff, I highly, highly, highly recommend that you go and subscribe. It is a free newsletter. It will be something that you are grateful to be reading on a regular basis. And I mean, you're just dumb if you're not reading it, but I digress. I want to start with slide number one. Sam, you tweeted out the other day, and this tweet is also pinned at the top for Twitter Spaces, but also feel free to come over and see our pretty faces on YouTube. There was a correction to some of this Glassnode data. Walk us through maybe what you're noticing that's like really instrumental that could make or signal a significant change in some theses, if that's the right plural for thesis, Or like, was the correction just like, oh, they had a couple of numbers wrong, but ultimately, like, things are still sort of where we were at with the bad data or the incorrect data, sorry.
Yeah, totally. No, maybe I'll start with a little bit of like a TLDR with kind of like what happened. So the chart we're showing here is Bitcoin's realized price, which is kind of the average cost basis of the network. So essentially with the UTXO set, we can see every Bitcoin that's moved, and essentially what price it would bought it at, or a market participant bought it at. So if you have one coin that's was $1,000 and bought, and you have another coin that's one coin that's $20,000, you get a realized price of $10,000 in between. So it gives a rough cost basis of the network. And it's kind of it's a really elegant way to like view Bitcoin's price monetization over time, because it kind of acts as this floor price. Is like you have a lot of speculation in the price between these boom and bust cycles and derivatives blowing up and changing that. But in terms of like the realized price, it's pretty consistent and shows, you know, this logarithmic growth that's pretty stable over Bitcoin's lifetime, especially through halving cycles and the boom and bust cycles we've seen before. So that's realized price. And then you can break that down into a couple cohorts on Bitcoin network, and Glassnode does this. They break down groups into short-term holders and long-term holders. Probably see those a lot. I'll probably walk through some of the basics here just to make sure if anyone new kind of understand those. But you'll see that a lot in terms of just talking about like Bitcoin's on-chain analysis. And what's useful about that is essentially you have you're breaking down two different significant cohorts that play into Bitcoin's market dynamics that can tell you a lot about like the behavior on the network. So a little bit about that methodology. Essentially, what constitutes a like short-term holder for a long-term holder is there's some good statistical analysis from Glassnode to show that after about 155 days, the people or market participants, an entity is less likely to sell their Bitcoin after holding it for about 5 to 6 months. And so there's a cutoff there to say, okay, as that, you know, statistically declines, you can still sell, people still do, it fluctuates. But they're less likely to do when you're long-term holders. So, you know, what this looks at is one, that's a group that hasn't sold in about 155 days in those entities. And so it's not just addresses either or an individual participant. They also do some analysis to look at entities. And then on the other side, you have short-term holders, which are more of like your price speculators, new market entrants, traders, things like that. And so the breakdown in supply of something like that is like long-term holders hold about 71% of supply. So it's not the best way to say, you know, when I hear long-term holder, I'm thinking someone who like holds for 4 years and doesn't move their coins. But it's a way to like cut the cohorts a little bit to kind of dissect them a little bit more. And so the issue essentially they had is like a bug in how they go about some of this methodology in getting some long-term holders or short-term holders in terms of like the supply and the price. And so what a big part of this was, and what this chart doesn't show, is here you have a realized price of $23,700, average cost network of the average cost base of the network. The long-term holder realized price is a little below that. What we're seeing kind of in their bug is like the long-term holder realized price had a huge drawdown. It went down to something of like $7,000-$8,000 of where it is today. So incredibly significant. And what that would essentially say, if that was true, is that there's a bit of a capitulation happening with long-term holders of recent buyers, essentially people who bought it 50, 60,000 6 months ago, 5 months ago, were essentially selling those coins in a huge way, which would have been kind of like this unprecedented event that happening on the network. Necessarily, that wasn't the case. Long-term holder kind of cost basis has been accumulating quite a bit. And so I think it sent this wrong signal in terms of like the on-chain world, pretty significant in terms of the data that we look at. I don't think it necessarily changed any like short-term market data thesis, but it did paint the picture that like these long-term holders who have been holding coins for a long time, this methodology that Glassnode had, essentially that they're going through this huge capitulation and sell-off event right now in Bitcoin. So making, I guess, making it seem much worse in the data than it actually was. So that's been adjusted now. You know, they fixed that just this week. It's been a issue that's been more pronounced over the last couple months. So that's a little kind of like short summary of that. Happy to go into maybe more of the details and if we need to, or just more about realized price in general.
Do you want to do the realized, the long-term holder realized price and realized price chart on slide 4?
We don't need to
go super in depth on the Glassnode stuff. I think your explanation, I think does it justice. Take a look. We have pinned to the top the thread or the tweet that you actually sent out. I believe it was yesterday, which is at the top of your profile. And just a reminder, if you are on Twitter Spaces, swipe all the way to the left and you can click the link right there and subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro. I see a few of you DMing me about that. Sorry, Sam. Let's dive deeper into this long-term holder realized price and realized price. I know that any time historically we've reached Bitcoin's price has gone below this, those have been historic generational buying opportunities. It makes me very nervous, quite frankly, that those levels are still between 22 and 24,000, roughly, just below 24,000. Let's dive into this chart and just sort of, what are you seeing? Is this that opportunity we've been waiting for, or is there still more bloodshed to come?
Yeah, totally. So there's a few charts you can get into. I mean, basically what it paints to me, I think you can make a good case for both in terms of bullish, bearish, is there more bloodshed to come? Something like this, and in a lot of this and on-chain too, you'll find like a cyclical nature of, just because this event has happened with a past and seems a pattern in Bitcoin's history, doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen again, but some of these market behaviors have been reoccurring and are kind of what have played out before. So I think what you're seeing here in like two color-coded ways is, here is like when you have the network cost basis, which is a realized price we talked about before, and then you have the long-term holder cost basis. And so what you would think of, like, you know, if the realized cost basis is like rising on the network, essentially that's like capital inflow that's coming in, essentially pushing up that floor price. And that's kind of like the total realized price at large. And when you think of that going down, you think of like a lot of short-term holders that maybe bought months ago or bought at higher prices. They're essentially selling, pushes the realized price lower. And then essentially that's converging on like where the long-term holder cost basis is today. So like when we've seen this before, it's been these times of like bear market kind of drawn out periods where have been like those kind of mega accumulation or generational opportunity times to buy in Bitcoin's history. I mean, we look to be closing in on that a little bit further. And essentially, you know, you think about long-term holder realized price is a little bit different than the cost basis of the network, because of the nature of long-term holders, they're always holding, like they have lower cost basis in nature. So when this really rises, it's some selling from that too, you know, older coins saying, okay, we're getting to this market, and is there going to be strong opportunity in the future, or should I take out and cash out now? And so we're seeing a little bit of that activity. I mean, on net, long-term holder supply is one of those things that fluctuates, but has grown. Now it's over 13 million coins, grown from, you know, 7 million over Bitcoin's life. So it's always growing and fluctuating. But what we're getting now is like, when you sell some of these older coins that have been held for a long time, some of that cost basis gets pushed up. And so essentially you get to a point where the overall cost basis of the network is below that of long-term holders. Then you kind of go through this like accumulation period again. So it's just one of those signs that we've seen before in cyclical natures, and got a couple other charts to kind of show some of those cycles, just to show kind of this interesting point of where we're at today. And before, you know, with kind of a Glassnode issue and realized price, we saw maybe this kind of mega capitulation in long-term holders. We're now kind of like seeing this steady rise in the floor price, but getting to a point where there's been a few times like in Bitcoin's history where you see price go below long-term holder realized price. It doesn't last long, maybe a month at a time. And those have really sparked those moments where like huge capitulation bottoms. So that's something in the past, not necessarily going to see that today. The next slide I have in here is looking at this just like realized price overall. And these are pretty subjective thresholds of like what we're looking at. So as I mentioned before, if you're looking at like the cost basis as a whole, you're saying like realized price is like the capital inflow that's coming into the network. So if that's coming in really steep, like over 10%, those are typically like your bullish FOMO parabolic type phases. If you have something like more in the neutral phase, not necessarily like a lot of capital is coming in, it's growing, Bitcoin's floor price is rising. And then on the reverse of that, you have maybe what you could call more bear market activity or territory, where essentially there's more selling on net at the market at higher prices that Bitcoin has bought up before. And, you know, maybe getting to that capitulation. And so you're seeing that decrease. So we like to look at it on like just a 30-day change basis. This doesn't necessarily tell you like what's going to happen over the next 30 days. Kind of just tells you the state that we're in right now, which is more of that overall, the realized price, that floor that sets in Bitcoin, that kind of pure monetization, has been declining over the last 30 days at a decent clip, and kind of in that state. And for me, you know, I look at some signs to say that maybe there's more potential capitulation or had, or more bear market territory to be had here.
Sorry, I didn't like the way it looked on the screen. One thing I want to point out really quickly during all this conversation that we're having, like all of these indicators, like it reminds me a lot of like oversold and overbought indicators in just technical trading with stocks. And one thing that like the very first thing I was ever taught when I started using oscillators was just because something is overbought, just because something is oversold, does not mean it can't get more overbought or more oversold respectively. And I think that's one big thing with all of these tools that you're showcasing to us here, Sam. Like, just because it says it's a generational buying opportunity does not mean that it can't be even more generational. You bring up the fact that like in historically, when Bitcoin's price goes below long-term realized price, I believe it was you said, or realized price, that happens for a month. It doesn't just like sit there and like reverse back. So just a gentle reminder for everyone who's listening that like just because it says something doesn't necessarily guarantee how it goes up from here. It could still go lower, but this is just a zone or a general area that you should take advantage of. I just wanted to highlight that.
Yeah, I think that's a really great caveat and point. You know, obviously I'm someone who's trying to study the market. And so from one way on chain, it tells you a lot about the just general economic behavior and activity that's happening and give you a lot of insights and information. And, but necessarily too, it depends on how you use it. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to turn into trading signals, and we're not promoting that as well. And I think for most people too, it's a lot about just like information and wanting to understand, like you have this really public, transparent ledger that is showing you this different economic behavior that I find interesting because you don't get it in other markets. So just from like an information insight standpoint, I find it that useful in terms of like timing bottoms, a little bit of a fool's game, but I mean, there are areas and like entry points where you say, okay, I want to say, you know, I'm going to put, if I'm thinking on Bitcoin from a long-term perspective, 5-10 years, I want to get the best entry zone I can get. Here are some confluence of on-chain indicators macro that I think is a good point to do. And I would say for most people too, it just depends on like how you view the market and what you want to do for yourself. I go back to like Preston Pish probably has the best advice for most people is, you know, take on a position, try to understand Bitcoin, and then like fall asleep for 5 years. So it really depends on what you're doing. But for those that are interested in the behavior and like activity, I think studying this in can provide some pretty good insights, at least knowledge at the least.
Sam, we have just under 5 minutes left. I mean, this is what happens when I have too much fun talking to people smarter than me. Is there a slide you want to go over or any final points that we should discuss in our remaining time?
Yeah, why don't we just, I think, you know, as we could go over the kind of market value, realized value Z score kind of chart last. I'd say for most people that are potentially not into on-chain or trying to understand some of it, there's a lot of great methodology and like statistics out there and math that's been done. And everyone's learning this in like real time. And so a lot of cool metrics out there have been created, try to understand like economic behavior and activity. But I kind of look at, if you're just saying, okay, I want to know where the price action is today or where behavior is today, and you're holding Bitcoin and you're curious about that, I would say the Meyer multiple is a great tool for that, price over 200-day moving average, understanding that. And then the other one that's more Bitcoin focused, because we've talked a lot about realized value cost basis today, is market value, realized value. Z score is just a normalization of that standard deviation of mean. And then this is kind of the how Bitcoin has played out in cycles in the past, not to say that it continues to do this. It's actually kind of dampened with volatility over time. Bitcoin gets these less explosive moves. But this ties back into the cost basis that we were talking about before. You can kind of see where price is related to its cost basis and how far off that is and where we're at today. So this has been a good cyclical indicator of trying to understand maybe where Bitcoin is at a top or a bottom, and kind of where we're at today is in like this 29th, 30th percentile, where essentially what you look for in bottoms, whether we get it or not, is that kind of price goes below that cost basis or potentially tested. So that number, you know, that 23,000 number we were talking about before, can be some pretty good confluence when you think about like technical indicators of price or where it could go. So I like to tell people, you know, this is something good to keep up with. If you're looking for like the downside case to be had, there's times through Bitcoin's history where we've seen this before. Price goes below the cost basis of the network. It's more of a bear style like market. So that's kind of like the scenario I like to paint for people just to be prepared for in that situation based on some like kind of historical precedent and data.
A lot of stuff for us to digest.